How's it going?
Thank you for checking in, and thank you very much for helping us become one of the fastest growing podcasts on iTunes, Google Play, and YouTube. Your positive feedback and comments certainly help out a lot. Always root for good dudes. And after 13 years of grinding away, Cody Woods finally had his TV breakthrough on Comedy Central's Heart of the City, Season 3, Episode 7, from Jeffries in Oakland. Right now, on the road with the Rolling Green Room stand-up comedy roadshow, working with his good friend James Myers. It's a thrill to catch up with him. A rare break for the hardworking and finally making it, Cody Woods.
This is where I got the most confused right here. It's like, he already knew what time it was. First time I heard it, it's like, hey, I saw Jamar at the gas station. He already knew what time it was. So I knocked his ass out right there. Knowing the time? Oh my God. You're not allowed to know what time it is in the black community. I have no idea.
Hey, before we get into your experience on the show, Cody, what about the person that's in charge of graphics and who put your name as Cody Wood with no S?
I think it was Joey Wells that did that because he told me he was going to fuck with me at the end of the taping. And I think he actually did because the credits say my name normally. The TV guide says my name normally. All the countless paperwork that I signed in order to fucking get paid and, you know, do the SAG dues and all that, it all says, you know, my name. But the graphic guy would have to go out of his way, I think, to miss the S. And also the way Kevin Hart said Cody Woods, it sounds, because I do video editing, it sounds like they ramped off the S.
So you say this was done intentionally.
Yes, I do. I do think it was intentional, actually.
Hey, where were you when you got a chance to watch the show?
I was in Colorado with my mom and my co-host of the Rolling Green Room and a little bit more family. We're in a hotel and we watched it. And my buddy pulled a prank on me, the co-host. He had a copy of some footage, and because I had it on my computer. It was for promo stuff. And then so he had an emergency broadcast edited into the you know, what looked to be just the live show, but it wasn't. So then, that's going to be a pretty good video. He recorded my reaction.
Is that going to be on YouTube? So,
Yeah, we're going to put that up. So it's a good one. Yeah.
Cody, what did it mean to you to be in the room with your family, in particular your mom, you know, to have that, you know, crowning moment for you?
You know what? Like, I think we waited for like an entire year for it. So I'm pretty sure normally it'd be like, oh my goodness, you know, this is the greatest, you know, thing. But we've just been waiting so long for it to air because it took 1 year. You know, it took a whole year. And then, so we're just like, oh, finally. We're relieved.
Yeah, it was almost a year to the day.
Yeah, it actually was. It was maybe 3 days off, 4 days off, because I think we recorded July 10th of 2018. And so, yeah, that was about, yeah, just, you know, about 362 days apart.
What an awesome experience. So, and that was going to air around the wintertime right before Kevin got into trouble with some things he said.
Yeah. Yeah. And we're thinking that they're just going to pull the show because he has another show on Comedy Central that involves stand-up comedians, and that got pulled. So I was thinking that, you know what, I'm probably just not even going to get showcased.
Yeah. I remember reading some of your posts on Facebook about that time saying, oh, man, you know the moment of your career, and it's never going to be seen.
Yeah. I mean, given the pattern of just the way comedy's been to me, it would make total sense for that to happen. It would make absolute sense because something always is weird about my path.
Well, I remember last year we were talking on a podcast and you were kind of nearing the end of your rope. You said, hey, you know, 10 years, whatever the number was, you know, if I don't get on TV by then, I'm getting out of this.
Right.
Well, you felt like you were running out of steam at that point? Like, man, I need a break real soon or I'm finished.
Yeah, I was really tired. And then also just the pain of looking at other people's lane and noticing that their lane was much faster. like, even though I like stand-up, it wasn't as the pain of the stand-up was just way more than the joy. So it's just like, dude, no matter how hard I work, there's no way I could change destiny. So let me just get out of this, because it's just too painful. So, but then it came through and I was happy, but then I had to wait a whole year to see even if it was going to air. So that was also very exhausting. But now that it's done, I feel a lot more relieved, man. It feels like a runner's high. It doesn't necessarily feel like, you know, popping champagne and celebrating. It feels like, you know, if you get off the treadmill and you have that runner's high, and then you feel like you can go run some more, and you kind of do want to go run some more, but it's not a good idea, you know, but you're addicted to that endorphin release.
Yep.
That's what it feels like. So it just makes you want to work a lot harder and try to do more.
You feel like now you have a little tougher skin, you know, maybe, you know, these experiences strengthen you and say, all right, you know, I've been through that long drought, you know, now I can prepare myself for the next, you know, bit of adversity that comes in your career, which is going to happen.
Yeah. Yep. I do have the thick skin. I definitely do. Definitely calloused, which is good. But I also don't have nearly as much energy as I used to. Like the first 13 years, I spent a lot of energy. So, but now that I'm like 30, I can kind of feel like I have to manage my energy a lot more and concentrate it. So, but inevitably there is going to be challenges still, but I have to be a lot more calculated, because like in my 20s, it was easy to go out and do stand up 5 times a night and operate on like 3 hours of sleep every night, you know, and then work in a day job. But I physically can't do it anymore. So, you know, that's something to be, you know, I have to concentrate my efforts on, like, you know, strategically. I am prepared to work all day though, but just has to be for stuff calculated that has exact results planned. I can't just be recklessly working hard.
Do you listen to yourself? Hey, I'm 30 and I'm battered and feeling old. I mean, I just want to like strangle you right now for talking about that. You know, oh, I'm 30. I've been through so much and I'm tired. You got a lot more to do, man. You got a lot more to do.
I do have a lot more. Yeah. I know. But it's just like, I need my sleep now, you know?
Yeah.
It's like really tough.
We were talking about, you know, Mario Hodge making it in 5 years and other guys,
yeah,
4 and 5, and you 13. So that's got to be pretty rewarding for you.
It is. It's rewarding in the way that the comedy community thinks that I pried the door open, you know, like nothing was given. I had to just like really grind my way in. And no one can really be mad that I got it, because it took a horrendous amount of time. So I'm happy with that. And what I'm really happy with is that my 5-year act on TV, I would be a little embarrassed. Just within a year later, I'd be embarrassed. I don't think I'm going to be embarrassed with this. So I'm happy with that, but we'll see. I mean, it's also, you know, if you run, you know, a mile to get a cookie versus running a marathon to get a cookie, it's also tough to think, oh, well, time to run the next marathon.
Yeah.
So I'm talking shit now, like it's all great, but you know, putting in another 13 for another TV spot.
Yeah.
I don't know if I have it in me.
More coming. It won't be 13 years. That's for sure.
I don't think so either. I don't think so either, but, yeah, I'm glad to be a 13-year comedian on TV, because it's just, there's a polishness that you get after 10, and then plus an additional 3 after that. I don't think I'll ever look back on the performance and be like, oh, I was too green, you know? And I know a few other guys, not to say their names, but I'm pretty sure they would prefer the version of themselves now versus when they finally got their TV spot. You know, because they got better. They got so much better over time, even though they're good then.
How long did it take you before you thought you were good?
It took me until maybe, it was recent. let's see. I want to say last year, because it was a series of comics, like 2014 and up is when I finally started gaining some confidence. Like when when Dave Attell liked my stuff and when Godfrey liked my stuff, that's when I was like, oh, okay, I think I'm actually good then, because those people don't compliment, and they're like in my top two right now for comedians. So that's when it kind of, that's when I realized that I was at a certain level. But, you know, once you're done with that material, you start over again. So, you know, it's right back to starting over, like year one. So that's my process right now. I'm trying to build a new hour.
The last podcast we did, you listened back to it and you posted on the page saying, God, I didn't realize I was as drunk as I was when I recorded that. At 9 o'clock in the morning.
At 9 in the morning. Yeah, I was with Kabir Singh, you know, and he's a drinker. So whatever we drank the night before, that was gonna go through all the way till like 3 p.m. the next day.
How tough is it, Cody, as a guy traveling around and you're up late, you know, just to get a normal, as much as you can, being healthy, you know, eating right and trying to sleep, et cetera. That's got to be tough.
That's what taxes me, because I know I don't think 30 is an old age. It's just that your options to sleep well, time zones, and food, that really just like it does a lot more than a 20-year-old would understand.
Yeah,
because you know they can put whatever in their body and they just have like this weird way to get through it. But like just today I went to the gym. This has been a few weeks since I've been in the gym. Felt great.
Love that.
Yeah, trying to find those time windows for the gym is really tough. And then just finding the right food. Luckily, there was a Subway next to the gym, so I got, you know, actual vegetation in my body, you know. Probably brown vegetation before the food coloring, but still vegetation. And then I'm feeling a lot better today. But we were so busy on this Rolling Green Room tour that we haven't really been able to eat right. But I do prefer to live healthier. It's just sometimes circumstances don't allow it.
Yeah, you were going to get a NutriBullet or something, right, for the road and, you know, make smoothies in the hotel room. That was the plan.
Yes, that was the plan. But you know what's hard about that, I realize, is it's not the NutriBullet, because you always think, oh, I just throw that in my bag and I'm ready to go. But no, now you have to carry lettuce and, like, stuff that needs to be refrigerated. It's a lot harder.
Yeah. You didn't think about that when you bought the NutriBullet.
Right. I was like, oh, well, I got it. Where am I going to put the carrots now? Like, I need a whole fridge.
Yeah.
This is the same thing. So luckily with this RV that we're on, we customized everything. Well, we haven't customized everything yet, but we're soon to. We have a fridge. We have an oven and all that. We're able to make a lot better decisions when we can. Our fridge wasn't working for a while, though, so that made us have to eat a lot of fast food, unfortunately.
What is this tour that you're on? I know you sent me a text, hey, for 2 months you're going to be on the road.
Yeah, so we're creating like a travel documentary, and we're just doing a series of gigs through this thing. It's a 1994 Sun Voyager, customized green with Rolling Green Room decals all over it. And we're going to do a podcast out of it. We're going to do a travel documentary out of it, and we're going to do live shows. So it's all just sort of one thing. And every venue that we perform at, we also promote their products. And then we also involve like a lot of crowd work during the show so we don't burn material. So the previous video that we put up, we had to do an outdoor show and there was a baby in the audience. There was like a loud train that kept going by on every single punchline. My co-host James had to deal with that. Every punchline, the train would somehow honk. You know, every punchline. But it ended up being funny because that's what kind of, I think that's what's going to make the documentary work, is it's not it going really well. It's the challenges of doing like shows outside of comedy clubs, way more distractions. How do you deal with it type of thing? And yeah, so we're doing that for 2 straight months. This is going to be our longest stint doing this tour. And it's going to be my longest stint doing any tour. So we have Minnesota coming up. We have, what else do we got, James?
Minnesota, South Dakota, Wyoming, Nebraska.
South Dakota, Wyoming, and Nebraska. Trying to work our way west for October and do a bunch of West Coast shows too.
Do you change your material a little, Cody, depending on, like, a South Dakota, is the audience different than San Diego, or, hey, I'm going to try some other stuff and maybe tailor it to the way they are?
Yeah. There's times where I can't believe how different they are, and then there's other times I can't believe how similar they are. I have both of those thoughts. You know, there's been places where I wouldn't expect them to know anything about the transgender bathroom issue, and they absolutely do. And then there's other times where places are just so different from, you know, they just have no idea about the coasts, or the coasts have no idea about the middle America. So I have both of those thoughts. And so, yeah, there is times I have to adjust. And then there's other times where I'm pleasantly surprised where they're the same. And I never would have. I underestimate the audience sometimes.
One time I asked you about a set I saw you do, and you actually make adjustments on the fly, right, based on how the crowd's reacting and just kind of the feel you're getting in the moment.
Yeah. So I do adjust. Like, that's just my style in general. I like to read and react. Last night I had to just, I couldn't write a set list for last night specifically either, because there's so many hecklers, but they're all good spirited hecklers. So, you know, you can't really snap on them, or else you lose the whole crowd. Cause they, you know, it wasn't mean spirited heckling. So you have to roll with it. And then, so if you have a plan, that's the worst time to have a plan. You know, you gotta be on your toes. So, I like to just read and react. Tommy T's taught me that. That's that comedy club, I tell you. And every time I compliment Tommy T's, it sounds like I'm shitting on him. But it was the best environment to develop in, because you had to be on your toes at that comedy club. You know, the room is not policed well. the tables are long ways, so everybody's facing each other. So they're tempted to talk to each other because they're staring at each other's faces. It hurts their neck to look at the stage. Yeah. So it feels better to look at each other. And then when you get all sauced up, makes you want to talk. And then the demographics that come, you have opposites at the table. You'll have, you know, the most ghetto people from Oakland and then the most redneck people from Modesto at the same table. And you have to figure out how to get them both on the same page. And a lot of times that's going to come with reading and reacting, instead of just doing a set list. So I owe everything to Tommy T's, and it always sounds like I'm trashing them, but that club really helped me out a lot.
Do you have a game plan for hecklers? Like, you know, some kind of go-to heckle material?
I don't. There's no way I'd even be able to remember it in time. I kind of hope for it in a way. So like, if you're kind of up there hoping someone interrupts you, you tend to think a lot quicker. If you're up there just trying to be idealistic, like, oh, I just hope I can get this set done, you're going to think a lot slower once you get interrupted, because then you adjust your whole mindset. You have to adjust your whole mindset and figure out something to say. I think it's better to be like, kind of like a counterpuncher. Like, you can't wait until they do something so then you can do something. Sort of aggressively defensive, if that makes sense.
Oh, it does. In fact, there's a great video on YouTube of a heckler in Cincinnati. And you actually give her the green light. Hey, go ahead. It's harder than it looks. And you go joust back and forth.
What?
I'll take your crowd.
You'll take my crowd?
Yes,
sir. Okay, prove it.
You don't want that.
Yeah, I do. Go. It's harder than it looks, huh, baby? When that pressure's on, he starts to fall, huh, baby? Maybe that's how it works. God chose me, not you. You are below me.
You know what it was? I don't know how she would have reacted if I didn't have the camera going. But I think what it is like, oh, the camera's running, I better look like a good person. So then she was like all nice and stuff. She was a mess, man. And she was even a mess in my Facebook comments, because I guess she added me and then she saw that I posted the video. And even then, she was just a little much. She's just one of those people.
Yep.
Yeah. See, I think it bothers some people, like, that there's someone getting a lot of attention in the room. And some people want attention. So they just naturally get competitive with someone who's acquiring all the attention. But I just need the attention in order to do my job, you know?
Yeah.
But they see it as Mr. Popular in the room, you know, and then they want to dethrone the popular kid so they can become popular. That's kind of like what their mindset is. But so it happens, you know. It happened again last night. I didn't record it last night, but it was pretty good. This lady who looked a lot like Richard Simmons just continued to was it Richard Simmons? Who's the aerobic guy? Yeah, his name is Richard Simmons.
Yeah, with the curly hair.
Yes. She looked exactly like it's insane. It might actually have been Richard Simmons now that I think about it, but like like just like a sunburnt Richard Simmons. And you know, she just kept, you know, chiming in just like every single punchline. And I forget some of the stuff that I said, but it happens, you know. People also, the art form is designed to where it looks like you're just talking and being casual. So even if it's planned stuff, you don't want it to look like it's planned. So then that what that does is people think you're really talking to them, and then they could talk back to you. You know, so
in a way, it's a compliment.
I think so. Like if they really are interactive with you, and not in a malicious way, that means they really think you're present, whether you are or you're not. Sometimes you are present. Sometimes it's actually just a bit. You know, like sometimes it looks like I'm talking to the audience, but really I'm doing a bit, and I'm wondering if I left the oven on, like while talking.
Hey, you mentioned Tommy Tees and what that did for you. In the show, you gave props to Oakland, and you were asked by Kevin, hey, what makes Oakland like the litmus test for a comedian? Like, if you make it here, you can make it anywhere. And you kind of gave a really great description of why Oakland is such a great place for a comedian.
What about you, Cody, if you had to speak on behalf of Oakland in the comedy scene?
You know what I like about Oakland is, you know, you can hit in the gut and you can hit in the head, but Oakland, you got to do both.
Okay.
Because Oakland's like a smart hood crowd.
Okay.
You know what I mean? Like, okay. It's got a lot of... You got the Silicon Valley there. You got a lot of progressive movements that came out of Oakland.
Uh-huh.
There's a sharp crowd too, so you can hit both. You can have a smart joke that also, where they laugh at your pain too.
Okay.
So that's how you get to laugh. You get laughs everywhere.
Okay.
Because Oakland knows how to give you both of those skills.
Yeah, and I really did mean that, and I'm glad they put that up because that's Tommy T is Oakland in a way, but Oakland in general, it's just. I do a lot of hood shows across the country, right? I do a lot. I do redneck shows across the country. I do every type of audience, which is rare. But the only reason I'm able to do that is because there's two skills in comedy. You could be really witty and cerebral, or you could hit them in the gut and you're just, you know, kind of being relatable with pain, right? But Oakland kind of requires both. So if you're going to try to be relatable with pain, you better get to it in a clever way. So it requires performance, presence, and writing. And if you have those three things, there's rarely a crowd that you can't conquer. And I think Oakland, honestly, it teaches you that because it is different, man. Like, I've done Philly. I'll give you a story about Philly. I did the hood in Philly. And it was a bringer show. I was headlining it. And if you're not familiar with what a bringer show is, they put a new comedian who still has a lot of family and friends that are excited for them doing comedy, and they bring in a big audience, and it's around the time where they still suck, so it's a very brutal it's a very brutal start in comedy. I was a bringer for a long time, and I've bombed in front of my friends and family, and I was used to fill the room, but I was the worst comic. That's what happened here. And this guy, he was from the streets of Philly, and he was doing so bad that he eventually just started saying, I'm going to put money on your head. I'm going to put money on your head. He's like making death threats on stage. And I had to follow it. And I was the only white comedian on the show. And then, so what I did is I just immediately started doing the same thing. I was like, I'm going to put money on your head. I'm going to put money on your head. I did the exact same shit. And then the Philly audience, I swear to God, they're like, well, why? We didn't even do anything to you. They didn't even catch the fucking irony.
Yeah.
I'm sorry to cuss, but they didn't even catch what I was like, you don't even remember a minute ago? And then they got it, and then they started laughing. So, like,
the irony, the cerebral part, it was just gone. Like, they're just all hammers and nails, right? But Oakland, they would catch the irony too. They would be a hard audience filled with tough people, but they're also kind of sharp. I'm not saying they're a smarter audience, but they're a savvier audience for sure, like in Oakland. So, yeah, so there's usually a big divide between the two. There's a comedy club manager in Richmond, Virginia. He says, with black crowds, you hit them in the gut. White crowds, you hit them in the head. But Oakland is like that crowd where you got to hit them in the head and the gut. And that had the biggest impact on me. Because at the end of the day, I am still technically a one-liner comic if you really break down my act. You really break it down, it's actually a series of one-liners, and I just construct them as if I'm telling a story or a bit.
What was your reaction, Cody, when you got off the stage at Jeffrey's that night and you had done it in front of an audience that was going to be, you know, seen on television?
Afterwards, I was satisfied with the laughs. I was hoping my strategy worked because I was going to screw over the editor to where he had to put up exactly what I wanted him to put up. And it worked, by the way. He did put up exactly what I wanted him to put up. So, but I was nervous on still if the editor had tricks up his sleeve, you know. But what I did was I opened the first 7 minutes about me going to an all-black school. And each tagline is like a Jenga piece. Like, if you take that out, then all of a sudden the bit doesn't make sense. So I knew if I string all that together and then in the last 3 minutes go really slow and do an okay joke, then they're just going to take the first 7 minutes and work with that, because that's what I wanted on air anyway. And that's exactly what happened. But I had to wait a whole year to find out if they are going to edit it right. So after I got off stage, I was actually really nervous. I was like, I hope the editor doesn't screw me. So sure. I went from like this euphoria. Oh my goodness. I did my first Comedy Central spot and it's in front of my hometown and with comedians that I know very well. That never happens. To then having an immediate fear of like, how are they going to edit this? And that's been my thought every morning for a year. How are they going to edit this? And now I don't have that thought anymore. And I got to say, like, I my head feels empty. It feels great. Well, I don't have any other.
Cody, is it the decision of one guy? I mean, who determines which part of that 10-minute set goes on?
Yeah, I think it's what it is. I think the director tells the editors what to do. The director slash producer, which is probably Leslie Small, who's a very, very powerful man. And then the team of editors, the one actually doing the editing, they're probably the ones that chop it up and stuff. So if I'm assuming correct, that's most of the time that I see what happens in production. And so they might have tried it a different way, but I layered the set just right to where they had to do what I wanted.
Nice.
So, and maybe that pissed off the editors to the point where they gave me the wrong graphic for my name. I'm wondering if that too, like, because like I left no space in that first 7 minutes. It's either I'm talking or that audience is laughing. There's no space at all.
He thinks
airtight.
He thinks he's gonna win. Well, I'm gonna take the S off his name.
Yeah. So I'm wondering. It could have been Leslie. Could have been Joey, because Joey Wells, you know, the producer of the show, also. He's from Oakland, but once he found out I was a Niners fan, like, he's like, watch, I'm going to fuck with you in the editing room. So, like, I think it's one of those two people. Because there's no way they did not have other documentation on what my name is.
Yeah, I mean, that's absurd. I mean, right out of the gate, you see who's on, and, you know, it's Cody W-O-O-D. I mean, right away, it's like, oh, come on, man. This is his shot.
Oh, yeah.
This is his shot. You got to get his name right.
Right. They knew what they're doing. And it also could have been Comedy Central, you know, because Comedy Central hasn't put up any snippets of me. They put up snippets of Mario. They put up snippets of G King. They got nothing of me. So, I mean, it could have been just their agenda. The show is to help promote black comedians. So,
and I'm kind of like the I'm the diversity card, so it's not in the incentive to do that. So I'm wondering if maybe that's it too. So, and it's just what it is. White guys have had it very easy in entertainment for a long time. So this is just a new era. So we have to fight for what we get now, which is fair, but also is going to mean a lot of unfairness
right.
in order to make it fair. So that's kind of what's going on too.
You like to live in the world where just the best person, whether it's a girl that does it, whether it's an Asian man or a black guy or a Cody Woods, who's the funniest? We're going to give that person the gig.
Yeah. I wish it was that way. I wish Hollywood would understand that meritocracy is already diversified, but they refuse to understand that. They will put on someone just because of a skin color or a need to fill a role. And if you really look at who's been blowing up over the years, they'll go in bursts, right? So 2008 to like 2012, you notice like Indian comics were blowing up all over the place.
Yep.
And then from like 2015 to like 2017, 2018, maybe even now, fat black comedians were blowing up all over the place, getting signed all over the place. So it's like, they go in bursts to fit like a type instead of just doing full on meritocracy. Because I tell you, if you list the top 10 funniest people, they're all going to look different. But it takes a lot of work to find out who's the best. It takes people to scout and scout and scout. And I'm sure they just don't have the resources to do it. So if they're like, hey, we don't have enough Asians on TV, they're just going to start picking Asians because they're Asian, not like who's the best person who also happens to be Asian. They're not going to do that. Yeah. So, you know, that's just what it is, you know.
Who were the people when you were coming up, Cody, that you really admired, that got you inspired to do this for a living?
Well, when I was a kid, it was Eddie Murphy. Eddie Murphy was very big for me because I feel like he was just the most talented guy like in the world. He could sing, he could do impressions, his jokes were insanely good, and like he was just perfect. And he was cool. He was like funny but cool. That like funny was always associated with not being cool, but he was like cool too. So he's like the whole package. So he had a big deal, and then he was a big deal for me. And then when I was actually doing comedy, the people that helped me out the most were like people that were like 10 years in that were still grinding. And then also guys that were just a little bit ahead of me, that they had a big deal. Like Ty Rivera, was always one of those guys that wasn't too far ahead of me to where he knew what I was going through. Because if I talk to a 20-year, 30-year comedian, he doesn't know what this generation's challenges are. So their advice isn't very good. But like Ty Rivera, who's like, you know, maybe 6 or 7 years ahead of me, he kind of has navigated the same waters that I'm navigating. Sammy Obade, another guy who I started with exactly the same time, but he accelerated quicker. So he navigated some waters that, you know, I didn't navigate quite yet. Kabir Singh, of course, Brendan Lynch. Those are all Bay Area guys. And they kind of, I had a really good support group in the Bay Area because they were very honest. You know, I was a kid in the scene, so they couldn't wait to rip me apart when I did something wrong. And that helped so much. I don't know if that's present with the comics coming up now. I think everyone's just very supportive and nice, but you don't necessarily want that all the time. You want someone to rip you apart when you're screwing up. And I got ripped up for years. And that really helped me a lot.
Ripped for your performance? Like, hey, that joke was stupid because blank, blank, blank?
Yep, that joke is stupid. Also, like, everyone, like, when I was starting, everybody wanted to point the finger at doing stuff that's been done before. Even if it's barely similar, you'd catch crap. Because if it's even remotely similar, they couldn't wait to rip you apart. And that helps, you know, with originality. That helps with like editing and just being honest and throwing away jokes that
maybe get a really big laugh, but you know, just because it's a tad bit similar to someone else's, you got to throw it away because you're going to get accused. So that helped a lot. Now I see a lot of similar stuff being done amongst new comics, and I don't know if anyone's really telling them that it's bad. But at the same time, those comics are also doing really well doing all the same stuff. So, I mean, what do I know?
So
maybe it's actually.
So, Cody, you haven't done the Harry Ant at the Barbecue Sanguini Goo Goo then. You people would pick up on that. Maybe that was done before.
Yeah. They might have picked that up.
Yeah.
How
many times have you seen Delirious?
Oh, my gosh. To the point where I'm actually delirious.
Yeah.
A lot. Delirious. But you know the one that actually – I saw Raw first when I was a kid. And that's when Eddie was, like, really cocky, you know, and funny, though, still. It was just like a – it was a new way to look at comedy. I look at it now, it's kind of dated, you know, because some of the things he was saying. Like, some of it was just flat-out homophobic, you know, and you can't do that now. But there's other parts where I'm like, wow, this guy really changed the game, you know, because it's hard to be, like, this badass funny guy. It's hard to have that bravado, because as soon as people think that you have an ego on stage, you're not as funny as the comic that does not have an ego. But Eddie Murphy clearly had an ego, and what are you going to do about it? He's still the best.
Yeah.
at that time.
Do you feel your appeal, Cody, is the fact that you're a pretty regular guy?
I think. I don't know if that's necessarily an appeal now, though. But that is just what I am. I was always kind of drawn towards comics that like transparency. This is not a good name to bring up, but if people could remember before the allegation, or Louis C.K., right?
Yes.
That guy, beforehand, everybody thought he was the most groundbreaking comedian ever, because it was just, it felt like just pure transparency. It was like he was in a therapist's office, you know? And I was like, oh, that, I think that's kind of more me, because it's, I don't necessarily have an act. Like, I'm not putting on a character. And it's also an easier thing to draw from, is just honesty. So that's usually where I draw from, is some sort of deep, dark thought that then I need to learn how to make funny and dissect. So that's kind of where I like to go. But who knows? A year from now, I could be different. I'm always up for change.
I know a lot of your material stems from, you know, going back to, you know, being the poor white trash from Kansas and, you know, dealing with, you know, being a kid in a black neighborhood. What about stuff now as an adult that maybe inspires you for material, whether it's dating or health or politics, whatever it is now?
That's in the process right now, you know, because I know I got to put that, this is what it was like when I was a kid stuff, you know, I got to put it away. I have to, you know, explore more things. Social commentary is always a big thing for me. I don't think that'll ever go away, but my personal life, it's all changing, and I'm trying out stuff talking about that, and it's just an all new realm. It's kind of scary, because like I perfected the other stuff. Now this new thing, I don't know, man. It's intimidating and fun. Now I feel like it's fun again, because when comedy's scary, that's when I'm having fun. Because it's like, you got to make it work. You got to conquer the challenge. And that's what excites me.
I think there's a great metaphor or a cliche out there that if the challenge doesn't scare you enough, it doesn't make you nervous, it's not worth doing. You know, it needs to, you know, create some stir inside you.
I agree with that for sure. Absolutely.
How many years did it take you, Cody, before you could actually consider yourself a comedian that could, you know, take care of business? I know you mentioned, you know, driving around in your car and being borderline homeless, you know, that you finally, over the last couple of years, been able to, you know, make it work for yourself.
All right. I think what clicked first, honestly, is the Funny Bones. That changed my life, because I passed an audition with my co-host of the Rolling Green Room, actually. That's how we met.
They passed both of us, which they never do. They never pass anybody, let alone two people in the same night. And then what that does is you get about 20 weeks out of the year for road work. And typically you're opening for somebody and then they'll headline you for like one night or whatever. And when you pass the Funny Bones, you also get to work all the, like pretty much all the improvs too. So it fills up half of your year for your calendar. And now I only had to worry about filling up the other half. So that took a huge load off. So that's when things got a lot easier. And I could confidently not have a job on the side. That took a long time, especially LA rent, you know, right? I was working telemarketing jobs and hitting the road for a long time. And that was really, I do not miss those days at all. Like, there is no romanticism at all on those days. That was awful. But then one day I was like, you know what? I'm just going to quit this job and try to make this work. I already got 20 weeks guaranteed that's going to come through. I just need to work really hard at finding other stuff. And so far it's been, I think it's been around 2 years where I haven't needed any other supplemental income. So
that's cool.
And then with the Rolling Green Room shows, that's pretty much triple of what I made at the clubs. So producing your own shows, learning how to do that, that's been a big deal. The Rolling Green Room stuff is actually really juicy because of how we had to start. Me and my co-host James Myers, we were under the same manager for a while last year, and we're doing this thing called the Brewery Comedy Tour. And eventually, the manager just started taking money from us. And the manager eventually fired me for taking club work over his stuff. And then James was elected to take my side over him. So then he fired James too. And then me and James were just homeless in New York in April, like months ago. And James had just bought the RV because we were supposed to tour under this manager with this RV under the Rolling Green Room. But then the manager's taking money, and then he tried claiming he's trying to plagiarize the idea. He's trying to say that he came up with the idea of the pilot we're going to make off of it. So we got in a big fight over it, and then he dropped me, and then James chose my side, and we lived in a RV and parking lots in New York for like a month trying to launch the tour. And it was like April in New York, which is still freezing for some evil reason. It's still cold. And every day we would just try to figure out how to build the website. How are we going to market? You know, what are we going to book? Like, once we get all this going, are people even going to book us? We didn't know. But now we've been touring for about a month, and we've sold out every show.
Right on.
So it was a very big risk. But now, like, the money is, like, triple of what we were making. And granted, the overhead is way more, too, though. It's 10 miles a gallon. And we're touring the nation. So
when you said you got to fill the other part of your schedule, does that mean you calling clubs in Iowa and Texas on your own saying, hey, do you have any openings? How's that work?
Yeah, a lot of word of mouth. I rarely call clubs and send emails because they're flooded. They are absolutely flooded with people trying to get in. So it really comes through word of mouth and being in the game for so long where everybody knows who you are. And so a lot of people reach out to me, and I just kind of got to put my faith in the universe that I'm going to get calls. Like this morning, it was weird. I was trying to fill out late August, and I've been trying to fill out late August for like, 3 months, and I haven't been able to figure it out. And then this morning I got like 5 separate calls for that same week. And that was literally this morning. I didn't know what I was going to do. But now I got it, and it's fine. A lot of times shows will cancel too. That's another thing you have to worry about. Once you have a set of shows, you have to worry about when they fall off too. Some of them do fall off, and then you really got to do some magic. And that's what happened in late August. I was supposed to have Indianapolis at a comedy club, and the guy just would not get back to me. And then he called me this morning. He's like, hey, sorry I couldn't get back to you for the past few months. They just made me not book shows anymore. was like, okay. And then I got an email from the Kansas City Improv saying they'll take me. So
there you go.
It was perfectly. But then I got two other calls for Atlanta the same week. And I was able to say no to those.
It must feel good to be in demand.
Yeah. And I just try to maintain that demand. And the thing is, you don't know your demand until you get booked. So you're kind of wondering, like, am I in demand enough? I'm waiting to get my week filled. I got rent. I got to pay it.
Yeah.
But then it happens. You have to be a little crazy to do it. And I understand comics that want to keep supplemental income. It makes sense because you really have to have a completely different mind state to walk the tightrope like that and sustain walking the tightrope like that.
What was your professional arc before you decided to go into comedy full time? You were on the path to be a blank.
I was on the path to probably be in the medical field. I worked in dialysis for like 5 years in the Bay Area. So I used to put people with chronic kidney failure onto dialysis machines and run their treatments. And just the sort of trajectory of that and the path of least resistance would be to become an RN afterwards, even though I really did not want to do that.
Yeah.
My mom was an RN. I saw what it did to her. It's just those people work way too hard for the amount they're paid. That's probably where I was headed. And when I was thinking about quitting comedy, I was going to go right back to that because it was stability. But I'm really glad I did not do that.
What was your mom's reaction when you decided to do this, when you were, you know, going to be an RN and then, you know what, I'm going to be a stand-up comedian and I'm traveling to Columbus?
Oh, man. She just in recent years, she started believing in me. For most of the years, she was like, you need to just go get a job in marketing or something. Go get, you know, some stability. But now she's finally believing in it. And now she would not allow me to quit at all. She would be pissed, especially now. Because she wraps up her identity in the fact that I'm a comedian. She tells all of her friends and stuff. So now I really cannot quit.
Well, how does she react to some of the bits, whether they're 100% accurate or not, that reflect on her? You know, my mom said, you know, just tell him you don't want to fight or whatever it is.
Yeah.
You know, it kind of brings her into it. What's her reaction?
So I got beat up a lot. You know, I didn't wear the right stuff. And my mom's from Wyoming. This was her advice. She's like, just say you don't want to fight. Notice how the black people are laughing at this? All the white tables, well, if you didn't want a confrontation, why would they proceed?
Oh, she's like, oh yeah, that's true. That's totally true. She's actually more thankful that I don't spill more beans. So yeah, so she's like, oh yeah, that's good. Keep that. That's for some of her favorite ones are involving her. You know, all the childhood stuff she loves because she remembers that. The next chapter, I don't know if she's going to relate to any of it. You know, she's a single lady just working her butt off till retirement. Her whole life is work. So I don't know if she's going to relate to the next chapters, but she certainly remembers my childhood and all the stuff I went through. And she's really thankful I don't reveal all of it.
Cody, how long were you the product of a single parent household?
Oh man. Starting from the age of 5, parents divorced. My dad was he was a real winner. He had multiple families and stuff, and they had split because he was selling drugs with money that was in the joint bank account. He would take money out and then just try to sell drugs, but he was also a really bad drug dealer, so he would lose money all the time. And so she ditched him off of that. And I haven't really seen that guy a lot. I've seen him every now and then.
Really? What's that like?
Yeah. Oh, it was weird. First time I saw him was in 2014. And that was after like 10 years since the previous time I saw him. And he heard that I was going to be at the local comedy club in Kansas. So like he started calling the club and bothering the club. And which really made me look bad. So he was in a rehab center And so I went to go visit him, and then, you know, we talked it out. And yeah, he was in the rehab for some pretty gnarly stuff. So he was a real drinker, and I guess he got really drunk one day, and there's these homeless tents all around his house. Luckily, there was no homeless people in the tents that day, but he lit all the homeless tents on fire. And then so he got arrested and then sent to rehab. So I was like, oh, so that's the chapter that he's in. And I thought, well, maybe I should just kind of be around for him. You know, even though he wasn't around for me, I'll be around for him because it sounds like he needs me. And then after that, he just like stopped talking to me. So I was like, all right, whatever. Okay.
Did you have to go through a period of forgiveness? I mean, you know, when you were abandoned basically, or, you know, going fatherless since the age of five, you know, that's got to leave an impact on you at some point.
It does. I always think I'm over it. And then there's other times where I'm like, ooh, I'm clearly not over this, you know, but what I did is I just forgot about it, tried forgetting. And, but then like when he reached out to me at the rehab center, I was like, oh boy, I'm not going to be able to forget about him now because now I'm opening the door again. And then I opened the door and then he shut the door. So I was like, okay. And then that kind of started it back over again. And I'm trying to figure out how to make it funny. I have good jokes on it, but because I look kind of young for my age, people, I think they feel like it happened yesterday. So they'll admire the joke, even though it's a really well-written joke, you know, but they don't like the topic yet about me and him. So I usually just stick when I just talk about my mom's school and all that, and I'll figure out a way to incorporate him later. But, you know, I look like I'm maybe 21, even though I'm 30. So people, they feel like it's a fresh wound when it's not. So I can't really talk about him, even though I got such good jokes on him. It's kind of frustrating.
So you don't think the audience would take that? It'd be more of an issue for you than it would be for the audience, wouldn't it?
But it's not an issue for me. But I think they think it should be an issue for me. But I'm trying to convince the audience, like, hey, I'm over this, you know. But they don't believe it. I don't think they believe it. It's too dark for them. But it's not too dark for me. But you know, if they don't want to. Sometimes you just have a look that does not go along with the material, you know, and it just, you can't do that material no matter how good it is. If I sold those jokes to someone else, they could make them work, you know, and it's just how it is. It's just kind of how people perceive you, you know. Sometimes their perceptions are just stronger than what reality is. So
there'll be a point when you age then that you get to use this stuff.
Yeah, it might. Yeah, it might, you know. I remember, not to bring up Louis C.K. again, but he had some really good stuff on his dad, and it worked because he looked like a dad now. So clearly he's over it, you know, but me, it looks like, you know, I kind of look like I could, if I shave, it looks like I'm in college. Right. So people might think it's too fresh, even though it's not. It was like so long ago.
Yeah.
So.
And it could be therapeutic for you too.
Yeah. It could be like a catharsis, you know? Yeah, but I think maybe that's another thing. They might think I'm venting to the audience when I'm really not. So I just avoid the topic now.
Yeah.
You know? But we'll see. I'm going to figure out a way to incorporate it because it's still missing. I always talk about my mother. Nobody even knows about my father on stage, like, at all.
I never even thought about asking until just this last, you know, 10 minutes during our podcast. I know the mom's a big part of the material. I'm like, wait a second. What about the dad thing?
Oh, yeah, man, I got some good stuff on my dad. That guy was a maniac. And honestly, he was, like, when he was around, he was, like, the funniest guy in the room. That's what was crazy. Like, you could be mad at him for doing, like, the most heinous stuff, but he knew how to, like, charm and, you know, funny his way into your heart, no matter how much of a just piece of shit human being he is. So, I definitely... Something about that rubbed off on me because I thought it was the most awesome thing ever to be funny because of him, because he was hysterical, but he was also a complete maniac. So he's a big part of my identity. I just have to figure out a way to incorporate him. It's coming slowly.
Yeah.
Really slowly.
Is the world of comedians really supportive, or is it cutthroat? Because y'all want a headline, y'all want to be the man. You know, what's that like in the community of comedians?
Some people say it's supportive. Some people say it's cutthroat. I think it's an even split. But the experience, chances are you're going to be around the majority of each, you know. Like for me, I was around a lot of cutthroat people. But you're also the energy you attract. So I learned how to, despite being around cutthroat people, is to change my energy. And as soon as I did, that's when it all changed too. So, but it is certainly cutthroat. And the people that say it's not cutthroat, watch out for them, because they're probably the worst.
Yeah, they're the ones, they're the ones cutting your throat.
Yes. Yeah. But my friend Todd Glass, you know, senior comedian, he said, it's about how you put yourself out there. And there are certainly enough to have an overwhelming amount of support. You just have to find them and put out the right energy. And as soon as I started doing that, that's when it changed. You can't expect to have good people around you just because you want it. You have to, you know, work on surrounding yourself with that, you know, so that helped a lot. But certainly cutthroat, certainly a lot of shitty people, more than any other group of people that I've ever been around. Like, comedians can be very awful people. And yeah, man, it's, you know, really bad. And like from top to bottom, you know, but the bottom, it's really bad, because like everybody's competing for everything and they're competing for scraps. So they're, you know, just imagine it automatically turns you petty, because you're fighting for like a host spot at the local comedy club, and the backstabbing that goes on just to get that over something so petty, that's what changed it. Cause the rewards are so small. You have to, you know, scrap for small rewards. The biggest reward after doing comedy for so long is finally having that circle that's great to be around and supportive. That's the best reward, man. Cause it took so long to build that. I was also a kid when I started too, so it was very easy to be cutthroat against me. So there's like grown men like throwing sticks in my spokes.
Were you naive at the time about people?
Yeah, I was so naive. Yep. And then it switched. I went to two different extremes. I went from super naive to then extremely jaded. And then now I think I'm out of balance, but I'm still probably a little more jaded, but I'm working on it. But that took a while, because I was, you know, like when you're in your youth, it's all or nothing, you know, it's all 80-20, like, you know, it's hard to have a balanced perspective, especially when you haven't seen much shit yet. You know, once you experience enough of this, then you think it's that way, you know, because it's your entire experience. So, but I still have my guard up, you know, in this game. But it's not nearly as bad as what I used to. Like years, like just maybe even as much as 5 years ago, I had a very bad outlook on comedians. So
a bad outlook on the business too, right?
And the business and all that. Yeah. But now you just realize that doesn't matter anyway, because it's all, I mean, you're alone in the game. So like, who cares? Just put your blinders on. And which is something I wish I would have just, I probably would have been more mentally healthy for a few years if I would have learned how to put my blinders on. And it was told to me by a comedy coach when I first started. He's like, you need to put your blinders on. And I just, it is the thing that he stuck to. Like he didn't tell me, oh, this is how you do a joke. This is how you do. He was like, you yourself, you need to put your blinders on. Cause he could smell it on me that I was codependent on people's perceptions, you know? But you know, here's the thing, the job itself is codependency. It's about the audience's approval. So you have to find that balance of not caring, but still caring. That's a tough thing.
Well, how would you deal with, especially the early years, bombing? You know, because you want their approval. That's why you're there. And then there are nights where every comedian has had it where they suck.
The audience approval didn't matter as much as the comedian's approval, because you could do really well and they're still seeking to shit on you. And if they find something to shit on you for, chances are they're right, but it's because they wanted to shit on you. They just need to find a reason. You could use that to your advantage and then improve. But I mean, gosh, man, it is, it is a nuclear bomb mentally, going through that. And going through that over and over again, it could make you numb and disassociated, which is a good coping mechanism, but not for comedy, because you still need to be sensitive to other people's perceptions of you. So it's a catch-22. It's like one of the craziest catch-22s ever. You have to not care and care, and it's odd.
Could you talk about, like in baseball, a relief pitcher that gives up a home run, you have to have a short memory because you have to come back the next day and deliver the goods again. And same for you on stage.
Yeah, you have to have a short memory. I think the short memory helps when you do really well. You do really well and then forget about it. That's a good thing, because then, you know, it won't carry over. You don't want positivity to carry over. You got to get ready for battle again. When you do bad, you should probably marinate on it and see what you did wrong. So technically, you got to think about the negative a little bit longer, so that way you can figure out what you did wrong. But if you did well, forget about it and get ready for the next one.
That is a weird way of looking at life, isn't it?
It is. I don't think it's very healthy, which is why I'm really glad I have a balanced life now, because you can see how comedians can go crazy. Because if you're wrapped up in comedy and this is the way you have to have your mental state in order to operate in it, and you have nothing else, you have no family life and nothing else, then yeah, you're going to have some mental health problems. So I'm really glad I invested in my personal life in order to, you know, compensate for that.
When you spoke about comedy coaches, would they tell you to think like that? Hey, embrace the failure and think about that and don't hang on to being successful.
They didn't really go too much in depth, because we were all just at level one stuff. You know, you kind of figure out the stuff that I'm talking about some years in, because even if you were to explain it to a fresh comedy mind, they wouldn't be able to retain it. You have to give them, you know, the simple tools, because that's pretty much all they can grasp. You know, so I went to one comedy class ever, and I'll promote him too. He's a good guy. I think he has very good advice, and I don't say that about a lot of comedy instructors, but there's a guy out of San Francisco named Neil Lieberman. And he told me I need to keep my blinders on, because I was too afraid to go up in front of the class. I wouldn't go up. I was too afraid. So my first time actually doing stand up was years later in front of my class, which was even worse. But I was too afraid to go up because I wanted the approval so bad. But there's a guy, I think it's not Stephen Pressfield, or is it Stephen Pressfield? He wrote a book called The War of Art. And what it is about battling your inner resistance. And what he promotes is, if you approach it like a hired gun, you know, a guy who operates for money and not the love of the craft, you might operate a little bit better, because you won't be as invested into it emotionally and mentally. And even though they tell you, oh, you got to love the art and dive in, make it your being, that's not a good idea, because you'll freeze because you want approval so bad. So that book helped a lot, and I'd say that's the most accurate way to deal with it, and probably any art form, because he was writing that book for writers and like screenwriters, but it's so applicable to stand up. It's crazy.
Cody, what is it that you want to do as you progress and grow as a comedian? Do you want to do a sitcom? Would you want to do movies? What is it that you dream of?
I don't dream as much anymore, man. I try to keep my head down on the short-term goals now, because I noticed that, you know, some people, they have a path to that and it's very clear. Mine has a lot of obstacles, and now I'm embracing that I'm one of those people that just reacts to the obstacles and keeps going. So right now I'm just trying to produce this travel documentary, trying to get from A to Z on that. And then, after that, I'll try to look for something else. I don't really look too far into the future anymore. And it's not like a hopeless attitude. It's not that. It's just that it helps me focus on the short term when I only think about the short term. Like, if you wrap your head around the short term, you usually get pretty good at doing what needs to be done in the moment.
Did you before, earlier in your career, think about big term, there are big picture kind of things, and not be short term minded?
Oh, yeah, definitely. When I was very idealistic, you know, and I know that works for some people. Like, I've known comedians where they're like, I've always wanted to do a sitcom. And then they got the sitcom. Like, just because they wanted it and worked towards it, they got it.
I realize that I have like a path less traveled by, and I got no problem being that way. It's and when you're on that path less traveled by, it's a good idea to just focus on keeping one foot in the other instead of worrying about what's in the distance. So I don't look too far into the future. I really don't. Right now, I would like to pitch this Rolling Green Room show to a network. If that does not work, then I'm just going to turn it into a web series. And that is probably about the midst. That's probably about it for my focus right now. And I'm really enjoying video production a lot. I really love video editing, as painful as it is. I love getting the right shots. I love it. Kind of gives me that same joy as stand up of like trying to make it absolutely perfect, like the perfect angle, the perfect coloring, the perfect, you know, like I love that part. So I would probably venture off into something video production wise and produce some stuff and shoot it. Probably shoot a special too. I'll probably shoot a special on my own, but I'm not too worried about a special because I can, with my equipment, I could make a special tomorrow if I wanted to. So kind of putting that off.
Well, I just recall a couple years ago, it was probably 3 or 4 meeting at Tommy T's for the first time, and I got on your little email distribution list and a complimentary Cody Wood CD, and you know, didn't have any idea at that time that you'd be a couple years later on Comedy Central and touring the country and on your way doing the great thing. So I'm really excited for you.
Oh, thank you so much, man. You've always been there for me. It's so cool to have you around, man. Like, you know, there's that does a lot, you know, like that sense of familiarity, of support, that does so much. And, you know, you've been around since, I think, what, 2012, 2013?
Yeah, something like that. I remember the last show I saw you at Tommy T's was a Thursday. And so there wasn't a big crowd. You were like a last-minute fill-in. And you even made a comment like, God, looks like I know most of the people here. Hey, how's it going, Dave? You know, I'm there with my five or six people at the front. It was pretty cool.
Yeah. It's my guy, Dave. Sometimes that makes it more intimate and more of a fun show. Because then it's like, you know, then it gets really interesting. It's less of a performance and more of a meeting.
Yeah, it was awesome.
Yeah, that's always cool to see you there in the front, you know. Yeah, man. I got to get you at Tommy T's again, man, especially when I turn over some new material. And I'm pretty sure October I'll be there at some point, and then I'll have some new stuff. I'm grinding hard trying to replace that Comedy Central material.
No, that's great stuff. That's great material.
Thanks, man.
Some of my favorites. How can people follow Cody Woods through social media?
Well, because I'm pushing the Green Room so hard, please follow at Green Room RV on Instagram. Our YouTube channel is Rolling Green Room. And then my social media, it's all at Cody J. Woods. But I'm really putting all my eggs in the basket on the Green Room thing. I have some very good video content out. It's hilarious. It's produced well. I got drone shots, man. We're making it cinematic quality. James threw in about 10 grand for the RV, and I threw in about 10 grand for the video production side. So we're really going to make this happen some way or another. It'd be nice to get a network behind us. If not, we're going to make it on our own anyway, because we're all in. There's no choice now.
Super proud. Much love for you always, Cody Woods.
Thank you, David, man. You're the best, dude.
Check out Cody Woods on Comedy Central's Heart of the City, Season 3, Episode 7 from Oakland. Currently on the road with the Rolling Green Room stand-up comedy roadshow, working with James Myers. The executive producer of the podcast is Hunter Lewis. You can subscribe on iTunes, Google Play, and YouTube. I'm Dave Lewis. Thank you so much for listening, and we'll talk to you next time. We'll